Welcome to the Tax Institute's new monthly series, Tax Insights. Each month, you will be hearing from Senior Advocate of the Tax Institute, Robin Jacobson, taking you through the key matters that the Tax Policy and Advocacy team have in their sights. Here's Robin to explain more.
Welcome to our monthly tax series, Tax Insights. I'm Robin Jacobson, the Senior Advocate at the Tax Institute. Each month, I shall be discussing the key tax matters that are in our sights at the Tax Institute's Tax Policy and Advocacy team. This presentation draws content from the monthly tax update materials, and page number references are included on each slide. This month, I shall provide a legislative update. We'll have a close look at the non-assessable, non-exempt income tax treatment of the COVID-19 support payments around the country, and also take a bit of a deeper dive into the state measures that are available, including those, of course, in the ACT and the Northern Territory. Then we'll have a look at a recent Law Companion ruling on the non-arm's length income arrangements for superannuation funds, have a look at a private binding ruling on the main residence exemption for foreign residents, and provide an update on single touch payroll. In last month's Tax Insights update, we discussed the proposed measure that would remove the requirement to obtain an actuarial certificate to calculate the exempt current pension income in superannuation funds. Now, at the time, that particular measure was before the House of Representatives. So all I really wanted to do today is to let you know that this bill has been enacted, and accordingly, this measure has now become law. So in particular, where there is a superannuation fund and all the members of the fund are fully in retirement phase, but it's not a segregated fund, they will nonetheless be able to use the segregated method when calculating the exempt current pension income. This will relieve the need for the trustees to obtain an actuarial certificate, which prior to this amendment was a legal requirement, but practically served no purpose because all the income was already exempt. This particular measure will take effect from the 1st of July 2021. So let's now take a look at the income tax treatment of government support payments around the country. Many of you will be aware that there was a legislative amendment late last year, which inserted section 5997 into the 97 Tax Act. Its purpose is to provide a legislative framework for certain government support payments to be declared non-assessable, non-exempt income, in other words, tax-free. But the legislative framework does require a number of conditions, and further, there needs to be a legislative instrument declared or registered by the relevant minister. So let's go through the detail. A support payment paid by a state, territory, or the Commonwealth government will be tax-free if it is paid under an eligible state or territory grant or a Commonwealth support program. And that program must have been first announced on or after the 13th of September, 2020. Secondly, this tax-free treatment is only available to entities that have an aggregated turnover of less than $50 million in the year they receive the payment. Now, in terms of aggregated turnover, this is drawing on the definition in section 328.115 of the 97 Act. So grouping rules do apply, and that means entities that are connected with that entity or who are affiliates of that entity will also need to be included in terms of their annual turnovers. What it also means is that entities with an aggregated turnover of 50 million or more will still be subject to tax on these payments. So it does form part of their assessable income. This tax-free treatment is reserved for effectively small to medium businesses. Further, the payment must be received in the 2021 or 21-22 income year for state and territory payments, or the 21-22 year for Commonwealth payments. Now, that's not all. What also has to occur is that there needs to be a request from the relevant state or territory to the minister, who in this case is the federal treasurer. The treasurer then needs to determine that they are happy to approve that request, and then further register the legislative instrument. So until there is a request by the relevant state or territory, and until the treasurer issues this legislative instrument and declares these payments to be tax-free, then they remain assessable income. The ATO has a webpage that talks about the tax treatment of COVID-19 payments. And it's well worth you keeping an eye on this webpage because it does list all the payments that are currently tax-free. So if you'd like to have a look at the ATO webpage, if you type into your internet browser, ATO space QC for quick code, space 63381. That's 63381. Then the first result will take you to this ATO webpage, and it sets out for you lots of information about the tax treatment of government support payments, including the tax treatment of the payments where they've been declared tax-free. Now, the implication of a payment being declared tax-free is obviously not subject to income tax, and you do not need to include it in the entity's assessable income. But because the payment is now non-assessable, non-exempt, under Section 8.1, any loss or outgoing that is incurred in gaining or producing assessable income is now non-deductible. So this has implications for certain expenses incurred by businesses where this has been spent in order to derive or receive the grant. So for example, if someone has paid their accountant in order to apply for the grant, then the fees paid to their accountant will not be deductible where the entity's aggregated turnover is less than $50 million in the year they received the support payment. So the blanket rule is you can't claim a deduction for any expenses that are incurred solely to obtain this non-assessable government grant. In many cases, it's not going to be solely. In other words, you might have general accounting fees charged for the period, and it may not specifically mention or identify the time that was spent in applying for the government payment. So in this case, you will need to apportion on a fair and reasonable basis. Ironically, it also means that for businesses that have an aggregated turnover of $50 million or more, any such fees would be fully deductible because, of course, the government payment is fully assessable. It's also worth noting that if there are any concerns about things like salaries, wages, rent, and similar business expenses, where in many cases it's a condition of the government grant that amounts from the grant be spent on those sorts of expenses, I don't regard those sorts of payments to have been incurred in gaining or producing the grant itself. It is a condition of the grant to receive it that the grant be expended on those sorts of business expenses. But that is a state government requirement under the guidelines of the particular grant. If we return to the premise of Section 8.1, it's designed to deny deductions that are incurred in gaining or producing the grant. And I don't regard that something like salaries, wages, or rent, for example, is incurred in gaining or producing the grant. It is merely a condition of the grant that the grant be expended on those items. In other words, those amounts should remain fully deductible, even for those businesses under $50 million of aggregated turnover. Now, there's a second implication when it comes to companies. That is because when a company receives these amounts and they're non-assessable, non-exempt, and therefore tax-free, the company, of course, won't pay any tax on these amounts where they're under $50 million of aggregated turnover. However, when the company distributes that amount out to a shareholder, if indeed it's not expended on government expenses, but they hang on to the amount and then they distribute it out, then there's going to be an issue in terms of the tax treatment when it hits the shareholder. It's going to be a frankable but unfranked dividend. Now, this is going to cause implications under the benchmark franking rules. And we have a blog on our website in the member portal that discusses this in quite some detail. It's in the context of the JobKeeper and cash flow boost, and I will be updating it shortly to reflect the current round of government payments. But the principles are the same. If, for example, the company had already declared a dividend earlier in the same income year that the amount is distributed out to a shareholder where it's sourced from a tax-free grant or government payment, then you may have already set your benchmark franking percentage. And that earlier dividend may have been fully franked. If the dividend later in the same year is, say, unfranked, then you're going to be departing from the benchmark franking percentage. This gives rise to a penalty under the benchmark franking rules, and you would need to lodge a franking return and pay the relevant penalty by 31 July following year end. Now, in terms of, say, the cash flow boost during 2021, 31 July deadline has already passed a few months ago. But if we're talking about the current round of government payments, then there could be some payment and reporting obligations 31 July next year. If, however, there wasn't a dividend declared and paid earlier in the same income year, but in the previous or a prior income year, then what we may have is a disclosure requirement. Because if, for example, you had a dividend that was fully franked in the prior income year, and now we're paying out a dividend representing this tax-free amount in the current year, then we may not have a departure from the benchmark franking percentage in the same income year, but we may have moved more than 20 percentage points from the benchmark franking percentage from the prior year dividend. And that requires a disclosure to be made by 31 October, again using the franking return. Now, in many cases, companies and their advisors are not overly familiar with these reporting rules and lodging a franking return. So if you think that you have a company that fits within these sorts of circumstances, I encourage you to read the blog on our website and, of course, have a look at the ATO website as well, because it does provide significant guidance on what is required to comply with these obligations. It's really just an awareness, and there's more to be said on this in the months ahead, particularly when we get to July and October of next year. These issues do not arise, of course, for trusts, because they tax-free amounts can be fully distributed tax-free, and there is an exception in section 10471 of the 97 Act, so that an E4 event does not happen when such a payment is made by a unit trust. Of course, that has no relevance to discretionary trusts. You will see here a slide setting out the tax treatment as we understand it currently of all the government payments around the country that are currently on offer, noting that a couple of these programs have already closed. Now, you'll see in general, when you look around that slide, that most of them have question marks. And that is because when I refer back to my previous remarks about there needing to be a legislative instrument that is registered by the Treasurer, that has only happened in respect of a small number of these payments. Now, it's also been declared in respect of the Commonwealth disaster payments, and I haven't got that listed here. But you'll see that broadly the New South Wales payments, so the COVID business grant, the job saver, and the micro business grant, are all treated as non-assessable, non-exempt. Similarly, we've got the hardship fund in Victoria and the business continuity fund also in Victoria. And just recently, South Australian payments in respect of the business support grant and the additional business support grant have also been declared tax-free. But all the others are either not tax-free or we're yet to see a declaration. And what I'm finding is there is quite a passage of time from when a state or territory government announces a support measure and the payments are then being made to the businesses, to when a request is going to the Commonwealth, i.e. to the Treasurer, for these payments to be declared tax-free, and then finally for the legislative instrument to be registered by the Treasurer. It's taking many weeks, if not over a month or more. And so I encourage you to please keep checking back as to whether these payments are declared tax-free. And I say again, you can refer to the ATO webpage, QC63381. But the message that I take away from this particular table is that the majority of the payments seem not to be tax-free. So I know there's a lot of commentary on this at the moment, and there is now a building and perhaps not totally accurate assumption that these payments are tax-free. That may not always be the case, so please check the particular status of the payment that your client has received. So let's now take a closer look at the range of state and territory government payments that are available around the country. Now, there is much more detail in an appendix at the back of this presentation. I'll make a further comment about that later. But for the moment, there is so much that could be said now about the range of payments. In particular, the New South Wales support measures was the focus predominantly of our webinar that we ran on Tuesday, the 21st of September. That webinar, which is free for Tax Institute members, is available through your member portal. So I do encourage you, if you're particularly interested in the New South Wales measures, although there is a detailed summary of all the measures, which is also included in this presentation. So if we take a quick look at New South Wales, we started in late June with the COVID-19 business grant. Now that ran for just 3 weeks. There are payments between $7,500 and $15,000, depending on the decline in turnover. And this is available to businesses between $75,000 and $50 million inclusive of aggregated turnover. The JobSaver program, of course, has been dominating the landscape for anyone that has an affected business in New South Wales or is looking after a client in that state. We've now got 5 different combinations of JobSaver, depending on whether you're a standard business or not-for-profit, whether you're a larger business in the tourism, hospitality, and recreation sectors, and that in itself is divided into 2 tiers depending on the aggregated turnover and depending on the decline in turnover. There's also a category for the non-employing businesses, and we've got also a new category for certain registered charities that have registered with the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission, the ACNC, and which are under one of 2 subtypes relating to social welfare and animal welfare only. Now, this allows them to have a decline in turnover as low as 15% rather than the standard 30%. More information has recently become available at attachment E in the JobSaver guidelines. So if you're interested in that, you may wish to go and have a more detailed read. New South Wales also has the fortnightly micro business grant at $1,500 a fortnight for smaller businesses. Now, of course, there is a lot of noise at the moment in relation to both JobSaver and the micro business grant due to the new requirement to reconfirm eligibility every fortnight. I spoke at length about this in the recent webinar, part 3 of our COVID-19 business support measures series. So I encourage you to go back to that webinar for more detail on the retesting requirement. Also still running until 2022 is the small business fees and charges rebate, which provides up to $1,500 worth of discount voucher, which can be redeemed in respect of certain government fees and charges. Moving into the Victorian space now, of course, the other major state to remain in extended lockdown for the time being, the Small Business COVID Hardship Fund provided a one-off grant of $20,000, but the decline in turnover had to be at least 70% and was only available to businesses that had not received support under a previous government grant program. Now, this particular program closed on the 10th of September, so applications can no longer be made for this program. It also required, just out of interest, a supporting letter from an accountant in order to be able to verify the decline in turnover, and accountants could apply for this on behalf of their clients. Also still running, we've got the Business Cost Assistance Program Round 4. And as it suggests, we've had previous rounds earlier on. Now, this provides payments of between $2,800 and $8,400 per week, paid on a fortnightly basis, but the payroll must be no more than $10 million. This is only available to certain industry sectors, primarily tourism, hospitality, health, and there are a handful of others. And these businesses must have been eligible under round 2 of the program, which was many months ago. So you're not going to be able to apply for this now. It's an automatic payment if you were already eligible for the earlier payment. There's the Business Continuity Fund, a $5,000 payment. And with all of these programs, if you're interested or think your client is eligible, you will need to go and look at the detailed guidelines and conditions that are available from the respective websites. There's also a Commercial Landlord Hardship Fund, in this context, number 3, and this provides payments of up to $6,000 by way of a grant, where there's been rent relief provided to tenants. One of the conditions is that you have not received any land tax relief. Also, we've got the Commercial Tenancy Relief Scheme. And this, of course, is a program in place where commercial and retail landlords can provide various forms of rent relief to their tenants, where the tenants are under $50 million of turnover and their declining turnover has been at least 30%. Moving now on to the ACT, there are two main programs available here. The COVID-19 Business Support Grant, $7,500 for a non-employing business and $20,000 for an employing business. Fairly standard here, we've got to have annual turnover of more than $75,000 and at least a 30% decline in turnover. That's a fairly benchmark set of parameters. Of course, they do vary across the states, but many have drawn on those two figures as the basis for their programs. There's also the COVID-19 Small Business Hardship Scheme, which is available to businesses between $30,000, so that one is, of course, directed at smaller businesses, all the way up to $10 million turnover, where once again, a minimum decline in turnover of 30% is required. This is a $10,000 credit in respect of certain government fees and charges. Moving now to the Northern Territory, which has been less affected by lockdowns. Their particular program, the Lockdown Payment Program, has now closed. That was available to businesses between $75,000 and less than $10 million turnover, requiring a minimum 50% decline in turnover. And you'll see the payments, of course, were much smaller than we're seeing in the other states, particularly in the Eastern Seaboard. Moving on to Queensland now, we've got the Business Support Grant. Depends on whether it's an employing or a non-employing business. Again, you can see the distinction there. Turnover more than $75,000, and again, going with the standard minimum 30% decline in turnover. Still sticking with Queensland, there is a special grant for the tourism and hospitality sector, where grants of up to $50,000 are available. Now, many of these programs are co-funded with the Commonwealth. So not that that particularly affects you in any particular manner, but it's interesting to see which ones are co-funded and which ones are not. In South Australia, we've got a number of programs which are on offer. There is the Standard Business Support Grant, and this pays grants of up to $3,000 for employing or $1,000 for non-employing. Just notice this one is turnover of at least $75,000 as opposed to more than $75,000, but sticking with the minimum 30% decline in turnover. And then if you're eligible for that one, there was an additional support grant available as well, plus another $1,000 if the business happens to be located in the CBD, Adelaide, of course. Then separately, there is a tourism and hospitality support grant. I couldn't find a turnover limit for this one, but certainly based on payroll figures and the amount you receive determines that. So up to $20,000 for an employing business. There's also the Business Hardship Grant, and this one requires a decline in turnover of 50%. And again, we've got varying amounts depending whether you're employing or non-employing. On to the final round of measures. So South Australia, there's also something called the Major Events Grant. And this one's based on how many people were expected to attend. So depending whether that's more than 1,000 people or more than 10,000 people, you can see that some quite significant grants are available for businesses that have incurred losses from having to cancel major events. Tasmania. Now, they've had virtually no lockdowns as far as I can recall, but of course they've been greatly impacted by the lack of tourism, not just from international visitors, which has been a big chunk of their tourism sector, but also from mainland Australia. So there is a micro and small business border closure critical support grant. This one does vary depending on the size of the business, but it varies between $7,000 and $110,000. Again, with that minimum 30% decline required. WA have had lockdowns, of course, although they seem to be escaping relatively free from COVID at the moment. Their first program listed there is now closed, but the Tourism and Travel Agent Support Fund is still available and does provide grants to those in the tourism sector. And again, based on turnover, and there are some payroll figures in there as well. So that gives you a rundown on what's available around the country. I think it's safe to say that things were a little more efficient last year when we're working with a universal program through one government agency, that is JobKeeper through the ATO. It certainly has been more challenging this year with all these state-based programs, and particularly for those of you that have clients in multiple jurisdictions, you've had to navigate your way through numerous different sets of rules. And this has been an added challenge on top of everything else that we're dealing with. So our thoughts are always with you. We know that the profession is doing an outstanding job looking after clients, and we all very much look forward to a breather when we start to escape these lockdowns and things start to return to normal towards the end of the year and into next year. Now, over the last few months, we've been talking about the non-arm's length income and non-arm's length expenditure rules, NALI and NAL-E. The ATO has now finalised its Law Companion Ruling 2021/2. And this is guidance on the provision that came into effect 1 July 2018, that is Section 295.550. The effect of 295.550 is that it treats income derived by a fund, including capital gains, at the higher tax rate of 45% instead of the normal concessional tax rate. Where a trustee incurs non-arm's length expenditure or doesn't incur any expenditure in gaining or producing the fund's ordinary or statutory income, and the parties involved are not dealing at arm's length. Now, one of the major issues with the new provision and the professional bodies, in particular the Tax Institute with our National Superannuation Technical Committee, have been advocating for years on this particular issue. One of the core issues is that if you have unallocated non-arm's length expenditure, even very minor amounts, then this can trigger this NALI tax rate on all of the income for the fund for that particular year. So you could have a $5 or a $10 million fund invested in all sorts of investments, share portfolio, property, etc. And there could be a non-arm's length expense, say a $100 discount, and that could impact on the entire income of the fund where it's taxed at 45%. So there is a concern that this is a very disproportionate outcome. Now, I want to go through some of the aspects that are dealt with in this ruling. And one of the issues has been this concern that if you are the trustee of your own self-managed fund, under the CIS Act, you are not allowed to charge for your services when you're acting in your capacity as trustee. But then we've got this dilemma where if you don't charge for your services, then this would be considered a non-arm's length expense potentially. And we've got this tension between the tax law and the CIS Act. So the sorts of expenses we're talking about could be actuarial costs, accounting fees, audit fees, costs of complying with a regulatory provision, trustee fees, etc. Now, looking at where a trustee is performing in respect of providing their own services and acting in a trustee capacity, let's look at two examples. In example 7 in the ruling, it says that the NALI rules, that is the higher tax rate of 45%, will not apply where the trustee or director of a trustee company is discharging their duties in a trustee capacity. For example, they might be providing bookkeeping or accounting work. If, however, they are providing their services in an individual capacity as opposed to a trustee capacity, for example, if you happen to be a licensed electrician, as example 10 depicts, and you provide those services to your fund for a property that it owns, and you don't charge the normal fee, then that's not providing your services in a trustee capacity. You're now providing those services in an individual capacity. So the NALI tax rate would apply in that case to all of the income of the fund potentially. But if we're talking about a property, it could maybe be confined to just that income derived from that property. The problem with accounting fees and the like is that that's considered an unallocated expense. It applies to the income of the fund generally, and that's why we could have an impact on all of the income of the fund. So to clarify, if you as a trustee of your own fund are providing trustee services like accounting or bookkeeping, you cannot charge under the CIS Act, and that is not going to cause you a problem under the NALI rules. If it's something like an individual capacity, then yes, that will be a problem if you're not charging an arm's length rate. So a couple more issues that the ATO highlights in the ruling as well. Let's say you purchased an asset under a non-arm's length arrangement. The ATO is of the view that all the income derived from that asset, including the capital gain when you eventually dispose of the asset, there could well be a sufficient nexus to continue to treat that income as being subject to the NALI tax, even if you subsequently refinance that asset, even on arm's length terms. So if you like, the fact that it was entered into under a non-arm's length arrangement originally, it'll effectively taint that asset for the rest of its life held by the fund, even if it is refinanced under an arm's length arrangement. So do be careful of that, but the ATO is of the view that that certainly could be a problem. Also, the ATO makes the remarks that the market value substitution rule will not have an impact on whether a fund derives non-arm's length income where the asset was derived for less than arm's length consideration. In other words, if the fund acquires the asset for less than arm's length consideration, so the market value substitution rule kicks in, which means we now have a market value cost base for CGT purposes, that still doesn't stop NALI potentially applying to it because the asset was acquired under a non-arm's length arrangement where the consideration is less than it would have been had they been dealing at arm's length. So in other words, you could still have an increase in your cost base to market value, but still have a NALI problem. The issues surrounding the disproportionate outcome that we can see when there is a small unallocated expense that can impact on all of the income of the fund has been a significant concern to our members. The Superannuation Technical Committee has been working with the Tax Institute and also tirelessly with other professional bodies across the landscape of the accounting, tax, and the superannuation specialist bodies to advocate for a reasonable and proportionate outcome and approach by the ATO. Now, it may well be that the ATO has limited movement here because of the policy underpinning this. So representations are also being made to Treasury in this respect. You can also see that the ATO has issued a practical compliance guideline 2020/5, and there is a grace period for years up to and including 21-22 in respect of this approach, given the guidance has only recently been clarified by the ATO. So I do encourage you to look at both the Law Companion Ruling 2021/2 as well as the Practical Compliance Guideline 2020/5. And you'll see those hyperlinks are available in your slide pack. You will be able to click through to those. So a change of pace here. Recently, a private binding ruling was issued in respect of the main residence exemption changes affecting foreign residents. The ruling itself was issued on the 4th of June 2020, but has only recently been come to light and been evident to people. So I want to go through the facts of the private binding ruling, and then we'll have a look at the outcome and what this means. So the facts are that a taxpayer was selling a property and sought discretion from the commissioner to provide an extension of 6 months for them to be able to use the main residence exemption, where it was the main residence until some years ago. They now reside in another country and for tax purposes are a foreign resident. The taxpayer says they were not advised about the amendments to section 118.110 of the 97 Act that made changes to deny the main residence exemption to foreign residents. Now that law was enacted in 2019 and it dates all the way back to 2017 with a transitional rule that ran through to the middle of last year. Now we all know that ignorance of the law is not a defence. So for the taxpayer to say that they were unaware of the change is not going to help them. But if we look at the further facts, they're in the process of selling the property, but due to COVID, that sale has been delayed. And we of course know that things like auctions and open for inspections have been very much disrupted through the lockdowns. They don't satisfy any of the life events tests, which you'll find in section 118.110, subsection 5. So The question is, are they entitled to more time and does the ATO have discretion to give them more time? The short answer is no, and the Commissioner replied in the private ruling, saying the Commissioner does not have the authority to apply the law, sorry, to not apply, let's try that again. The Commissioner does not have the authority to not apply the law to a particular taxpayer's circumstances, and the law provides the Commissioner with no discretion. Now, from my perspective, this taxpayer was never going to have any other outcome. The law does not contain a discretion, and so there was no ability for the taxpayer to write to the Commissioner. I mean, they can write to them through a private binding ruling, but they were never going to get a different outcome here. What I think this does highlight is these rules were enacted before COVID. And we know that people are having trouble selling property in the current environment due to the restrictions about auctions and open for inspections and the like. And also we're finding also there are people overseas who have been stranded there well beyond times that they expected to be overseas. And in order to keep funding their existence overseas, they've had to sell their Australian property, which they were not reckoning on doing. They've been unable to get back to Australia because of the various restrictions and border closures and, of course, inability to get flights. And we've all heard about the media commentary on all of that. So it becomes very difficult when someone is stranded overseas, needs money, is forced to sell their Australian home, and as a result pays full CGT back to the original date of acquisition and using the original cost base. So I wanted to share with you all that we are going to be making some representations to the government on this one, and we are going to try and advocate for a better outcome, given none of this was contemplated when it was drafted, and the fact that COVID has come along and made it incredibly difficult and resulting in adverse tax implications for certain former expats, it's a very difficult situation. And just a final comment to wrap up with on single touch payroll before I make a final comment on the appendix that is still to come. STP, I just wanted to advise you that the practice statement 2011-15, which deals with lodgement obligations, due dates and deferrals, has recently been updated to factor in for the first time the lodgement obligations that are due under STP, including making a finalisation declaration broadly by the 14th of July. There are special rules, of course, for employers with closely held payees. And also to talk about the date that something is considered to be lodged. And when we're talking about submitting something through STP-enabled software, it is the date on which the lodgement confirmation or the receipt number is generated based on the fact it was submitted on that day. I also wanted to provide an update on phase two of STP, which is going to, of course, expand the STP reporting and is designed to reduce the reporting burden for employers who need to report information about their employees to multiple government agencies, including Services Australia. Now, the start date is 1 January this year, 2022. I'll do that one again, Sarah. The start date is 1 January 2022, but we've now got a reprieve. And this is something that the Tax Institute in particular has been advocating on for many months. Some employers would have found it difficult with all of the other disruptions caused by COVID to also meet their new reporting obligations from the 1st of January next year. So this is very pleasing to see that the ATO has said, if your solution is ready by the 1st of January, you should start reporting through STP phase two. Now, if your digital service provider is not yet ready, then they would have themselves applied for a deferral, and that will cover any of their clients who use their software. But the ATO has gone further and said, if you're able to start reporting before the 1st of March next year, then you will be considered to have met your reporting obligations under phase two. So in other words, there is a 2 month reprieve here. Early part of next year, businesses will be able to get themselves set up and still be considered to be complying and reporting on time. So very welcome development there. So my final comment, there is an appendix now which contains 16 hidden slides, but they are available in your slide pack. These slides set out much more detail on the business support measures that are available in the states and territories right around the country, other than New South Wales, because that has been covered in great detail through our recent webinar series. Please be mindful that this is all very fluid, so there could be minor variations between the monthly tax update materials, which were finalised a little earlier, and this slide pack, which was finalised yesterday, the day before this recording today. And as a result, I've tried to give you the most up-to-date information. So if you do see some minor variations, please check back to the website to make sure you have got the most up-to-date information. So that's all for this month, and we look forward to bringing you more tax insights next month.
Thanks, Robin, for your presentation. We trust today's insights have provided you with a valuable update. The Tax Institute is committed to providing members with timely and relevant content, and we look forward to engaging with you again next month.